So if we go back into the commentary that we're looking at the moment, down the bottom of page 96, it says, when you experience emotions such as attachment, anger, and delusion, train the mind in the following manner. Sadly, just as I indulge in sensual pleasures now, countless beings in the universe are dominated by desire and thus indulge in infinite negative acts. Extract all of these attachments of other beings in one fell swoop, taking them into your heart and praying, may all these beings, sentient beings, be endowed with the virtuous root of non-attachment. In the same manner, extend this practice to all five poisons. So here then, we have the three objects, three poisons, and three roots of virtue. So here it's talking about the first of these is non-attachment. Is the root of virtue, opposite to attachment. And the second one was non-aversion, was listed as anger, the poison. So the root of virtue normally is listed as, non-hatred, non-anger, sometimes non-hatred, non-anger. And then non-ignorance. If we look at those in a positive perspective, then non-attachment, we could say, is loving kindness. Non-hatred would be compassion. And non-ignorance here could be wisdom or even equanimity. So what this commentary is saying is that if we notice ourselves getting caught up in these mental afflictions such as attachment and anger, then rather than allowing ourselves to get caught up in them, then we should, as it says here, purify the fields of your experience, meaning if we have, for example, attachment arising, then as the commentary suggests, then we can think there must be many other beings in the universe at the moment with attachment, but maybe even much worse attachment than me that is resulting to a lot of non-virtuous, harmful behavior. So then we can, instead of getting caught up in our attachment, is to take on all of that attachment of all other beings, as in the Tonglen practice. And then give them the opposite of attachment, which is non-attachment or loving kindness. So send out loving kindness to them. Which means that we can use our mental afflictions as the basis for increasing loving kindness and compassion through this Tonglen practice. So that's what's being mentioned here, is that we can purify these negative states of these mental afflictions in our daily life in this manner. So it says, in the same manner, extend the practice to all five poisons. So of course here we're talking about three poisons, so we would do that also for anger. Then if we notice we're getting caught up in anger, then use that as an opportunity to take the anger from everyone else, dissolve it into the self-cherishing mind or our Buddha nature, and then send out the opposite would be to send out compassion to all of these beings. And then here it talks about the five poisons. So the five poisons are the three, and then added to that is normally Jealousy and pride are normally listed as the five poisons. And then we're going to look at the six root afflictions a little bit later in the text. They come up later. So basically what it's saying is here, whatever mental affliction we have arising, jealousy or craving or whatever, when we notice that arise, we can do this practice of taking that mental affliction away from everyone else in the universe who maybe has that now, and then sending the positive opposite of that in terms of loving kindness, compassion and wisdom to them. So that is the practice that's mentioned here. And then the second slogan here on the top of page 97, what can also be helpful in daily life, it says, in all actions, train by means of the words. And what that says is this line pertains to training the mind by means of mere words, meaning to remind ourselves of what we're trying to do in daily life using very short sayings. And there's a couple of examples coming up. It says, for instance, recite the following lines from a treatise. May the suffering of all beings ripen upon me. Through my virtues, may they all achieve happiness. Alternatively, you can recite the following when no one is around. May the sufferings of all sentient beings and those sufferings' causes ripen upon me. And may my own self be subdued and annihilated. So here when it says my own self, of course it's talking about self-grasping and self-cherishing. May my virtues ripen on all sentient beings and may they become endowed with happiness. So again, here we can use some little saying to remind us of this exchanging self with others, taking on the sufferings of others and giving them happiness. From the depths of your bones, not from the depths of your heart, the depths of your bones, cultivate the thought, oh my dear mothers, my dear brothers and sister sentient beings, most dear indeed are all these beings. And so it says, this training by means of words in your four daily activities involves following the sutra's admonition to cultivate loving and kindness by means of mere words. So this section is saying that to use these little sayings throughout the day to remind us of what we are trying to do here with this practice. So this can be a very powerful way of really integrating this practice of Tonglen in our daily life. And here it talks about the four daily activities. Sometimes that's mentioned as whether we are walking, standing, lying or sitting. So often that's the way that is described. Walking, standing, lying or sitting. Basically means whatever we do in our daily life, we can do this practice. And to talk a little bit more about this last slogan here, I'd like to read a little bit again from this book, from Chalak Gyapkon, Modern Day Kagyu Practitioner, on page 75. He says the following. It's not a matter of simply parroting these slogans once we've developed familiarity with them. We have to use them to bring about a real change in our outlook. Words and phrases can have a positive or a negative impact on us depending on their content. If we really think about these slogans and understand their profound subtleties, they will help us to maintain our bodhisattva attitude and interrupt our negative flow of thoughts. According to the Lojong teachings, we cannot underestimate the power of these sayings. Every time we remember a slogan, it will automatically help us not to react to things in our usual habitual way. And then a little bit more on page 76. Buddhists believe that everything we think, feel and do will result in karmic imprints. The kinds of imprints we leave in our minds through meditation are extremely important, because they redirect the mind in a positive way. That's why we need to think about these slogans and burn their messages deeply into our minds. If we can do that properly, the Lojong slogans will pop up automatically in post-meditation situations and will change our mind. This mental self-talk or internal dialogue is very important. It is a form of mental conditioning because we become what we think and we think what we become. We talk to ourselves all the time anyway, but often that is just a form of negative feedback. These Lojong exercises will help us to correct that defeatist habit. Transformation doesn't come from changing our mannerisms or our way of talking. It comes from learning to think about things differently. So these are the two slogans that I mentioned. Also what we're going to find in the next section, section 3, we're also going to find some more practical advice about how to use this Tonglen approach in daily life as well, particularly when we talk about these adverse conditions, difficult situations, how to use particularly this Tonglen approach in using those difficult situations as opportunities. So there's more to be said in the next section. But that's all I wanted to mention now, before now going on to the third of the 7 points, which is to taking adverse conditions onto the path of enlightenment. So before I do that, any last questions about anything we've just covered? Okay, let's now then go on to the third of the 7 points. So the second point now, we've finished the main practice, the wisdom and compassion practice, how to practice emptiness in meditation and daily life, and then how to practice the compassion, the exchanging self with others, how to do that in meditation through Tonglen and in also in daily life. Now the third point here is taking adverse conditions into the path of enlightenment. And so to introduce that, we'll just look at the first slogan here, which says, the third, taking adverse conditions onto the path of enlightenment, is presented by the following lines. When the world and its inhabitants boil with negativity, transform adverse conditions into the path of enlightenment. So before we go into the commentary, I'd just like to read a little bit from the other commentary, modern day commentary, Buddhism with an Attitude, from Alan Wallace, on his introduction to this third point. And this is on page 189. And he says the following. If spiritual practice is put on hold every time adversity strikes, years of practice will produce no result except frustration and disappointment. This cannot be written off as bad luck or a defect in the practice one has been taught. The ability to transform adversity into the path is absolutely imperative for spiritual practice to flourish. Transforming adversity into the path is the subject of the third point of the mind training. Is it possible to attain enlightenment in our circumstances and in this lifetime? Enlightenment doesn't happen in a single flash. It is not an all or nothing proposition, for there are many stages of realization prior to the enlightenment of a Buddha. Attaining meditative quiescence, ascertaining primordial awareness, cultivating the heart, so that bodhicitta, the spirit of awakening, arises effortlessly. These stages are the central themes of Tibetan Buddhist practice. The 7-point mind training is a synthesis of practices aimed at the attainment of enlightenment, stage by stage. If spiritual awakening is the highest priority in life, the greatest passion, enlightenment is possible. What is required is a ferocious appetite for Dharma that consume every second of your life, turning our whole lives into spiritual practice. Dharma is not just sitting cross-legged, following the breath, watching our minds, or engaging in visualization practices. Dharma also encompasses what we might ordinarily consider downtime, moments when a richness of understanding can develop. Dharma includes being ingenious to do what you can do in the midst of whatever obstacles arise. The more ferocious we become, the more opportunities we see to transform all of life into Dharma. You do not have to be a monk or a nun to attain enlightenment. It is not necessary to spend your life in retreat. What is necessary is voraciousness, transforming all of life, family, job, good and bad, everything into Dharma. In this text here, the 7-point mind training, we have 57 sayings. Only 6 of those come within this third section of transforming adverse conditions in the path of enlightenment. But in the commentary, 1/3 of the whole commentary is in this section, which means I think there's a lot of emphasis on this third section. You know, that there's a lot of practical advice here and importance in terms of being able to see difficult situations in our life as opportunities rather than problems. So let's see how we can do that. So here the first slogan is a very general one, that when the world and its inhabitants boil with negativity, transform adverse conditions into the path of enlightenment. So let's have a look now at the commentary here. It says, whatever harms befall you, whether caused by living beings or caused by natural elements, they are fruits of your own past negative actions. Harms are seen as adversities and obstacles by those unfamiliar with Dharma. So again, we tend to see difficult situations as problems or obstacles. But for someone who has entered the gateway of Dharma, the master said, so again, the master is Geshe Chikawa, they are exactly like what Chengawa explained to Shaopa Gangpa. So these are two other Kadampa masters from early Tibetan Buddhism. If someone possesses mind training, all of this, physical illness and mental suffering, is skillful means through which the teachers and the three jewels bestow their blessings and higher attainments. Therefore, you should transform all circumstances into factors conducive for training in the awakening mind. So that's the general introduction. And basically it's saying that we should see, no matter what the situation is, whether it's favorable or it seems to be a difficult situation, we can transform all conditions into conducive conditions for spiritual practice. And this then is, it says, is two paths. The first is A, training in the two awakening minds, the extraordinary thoughts. So the two awakening minds is again the wisdom and compassion. So that means how to use the wisdom of emptiness and the bodhicitta, in how to use those in terms of transforming adverse conditions into the path. And the second one is striving in the dual practice of accumulation and purification, the extraordinary activities. So therefore, how to use these difficult situations to help us to accumulate, to do virtuous actions and to purify negative actions. So that's the second part of the answer. So first here now, we're going to look at the training in the two awakening minds, the extraordinary thought. So here we're going to look at how we can take adverse conditions into the path in terms of bodhicitta and in terms of the wisdom of emptiness. So here first we're going to look at the conventional awakening mind. So this is the, of course, the idea of exchanging self with others. So the first one is taking adverse conditions onto the path of enlightenment by means of training in the conventional awakening mind. Taking adverse conditions onto the path by means of the conventional awakening mind is taught first. So how does one take these adverse conditions onto the path? So here the short answer is the following. it says, reflect. Since beginningless time, I have failed to distinguish between enemies and friends. And as a result, I have failed to recognize what is to be relinquished and what is to be adopted. I have erred because whatever spiritual practices I may have pursued have all been endeavors of self-grasping. I have come no closer to establishing familiarity with liberation and the Buddha's omniscience. Today, I shall therefore differentiate enemies from friends and shall ensure the success of my Dharma practice. Now my own self is the enemy and sentient beings are the friends. So again, my own self is the enemy is my own self-grasping and self-cherishing. So other than viewing my own self as the enemy and relinquishing myself, so again, relinquishing myself means to relinquish self-grasping and self-cherishing, and viewing others as friends and cherishing them, nothing else is to be done. So what this is saying is that now we tend to have the wrong idea of who or what is our friend and who or what is our enemy. We tend to feel as if the self-cherishing mind is our friend, bringing us happiness, and that others, particularly those who try to harm us, are the enemy. But what it's saying here is, in fact, it's the exact opposite. It's actually our self-cherishing mind that is our worst enemy, and that others, even those who try to harm us, are our friends. So let's have a look at those two points. And the first point is how to recognize your own self as the enemy. So again, when it says your own self as the enemy, we are talking about self-grasping, self-cherishing mind. How to see that as our enemy. So it says, as for the reason why your own self is the enemy, again, self-grasping, self-cherishing, this is presented in the following line. Banish all blames to a single source. So again, we tend to blame our problems and suffering on other people and other things. But here, the instruction is to banish all blames to a single source. And so it says here in the commentary, this line presents the perceiving of your own self, again, the self-cherishing mind, as the enemy. Whatever calamities befall you, without blaming others, you should think, this is due to my own self-grasping. In this manner, scatter all the accusations fermenting within yourself. It is being taught. So here we have, to back up this statement, again, we have a number of quotes here. Again, the first one is from this classic text by Shantideva, his Bodhisattva Charyavatara from, again, chapter 8. He says, whatever harms exist in the world, whatever dangers and suffering there are in the world, all these arise from grasping itself. What use is this great demon for me? The second quote here is coming from a text by Dharmakirti. The text is Pramanavartika, Valid Cognition. Dharmakirti was a great Indian master, also around the, I think, 7th century. And he said, if there is self, recognition of others arises. On this division of self and others, grasping and anger arise. In relation to these two emotions, all calamities come into being. So here we can see a little bit, a condensed sort of version of this 6 steps that we looked at in some detail the other day, you know, the suffering and its causes. If there is self, recognition of others arises, meaning if there is grasping, self-grasping, ignorance, then there's self, and then recognize there's others or the world, independent of us. Then, of course, on this division of self and others, this division of me and others or me and the world, then if we encounter pleasant situations, we have grasping or attachment. If we have unpleasant situations, we have aversion, and if it's a person, then that can lead to anger, hostility, and hatred. And then in relation to these two, all calamities come into being, meaning that these are driving all the other mental afflictions, and that leads to all sorts of problems and sufferings. And then we have another quote here. This again is coming from Shantideva from chapter 8 of his Bodhisattva Charyavatara. He says, recognizing myself as flawed and others as an ocean of higher qualities, I will thoroughly discarding grasping itself and practicing embracing others. Now, before we go further into the commentary, again, I just like to read a little bit from this book from Alan Wallace about this point here, about banishing all blames to a single source. And this is on page 194. Consider the nature of adversity. At first glance, adversity seems to be something that we perceive objectively. If our fundamental motivation, our central desire, is to have a comfortable life, then we will try to structure our circumstances to make sure this happens. But the task of modifying the environment, including all the people in it, into a constant stream of pleasant experiences, so that adversity never arises, will lead to almost constant frustration. On the other hand, if our highest priority is spiritual awakening, transforming the mind so that it becomes its own source of well-being, then our orientation to people and environment around us will be quite different. With this motivation, adversity appears malleable, not fixed. When the top priority is pleasure, adversity will always appear as bad. If the top priority is to attain spiritual awakening, adversity becomes an important element of practice. How can adversity be transformed into the path to cultivate the two bodhicittas, ultimate and relative? Geshe Nawan Dagi commented to me once. He was one of his teachers here in India in the, I think, the 70s. He commented to me once, he said, now he's quoting Geshe Nawan Dagi, he said, "No one has ever attained enlightenment during the course of an easy, comfortable life." This statement means that no one attains enlightenment gliding along from one pleasant circumstance to another. It never happens in this universe. All of us experience adversity. No one attains enlightenment easily. Enlightenment is accomplished by being voracious, by transforming all of life, the good, the bad, and the weird, into the path. It is impossible to mature spiritually without developing fortitude, patience, forbearance, and equanimity. Before Buddhism was brought to Tibet, Tibetans were known throughout Central Asia as a warrior race, so they could easily relate to the many warfare analogies for spiritual practice in Buddhist sayings. The first difficulty in this battle is to recognize the true enemy, self-centeredness, and the true ally, the sense of cherishing others. The Buddhist definition of enemy is a person who maliciously makes you suffer. An enemy is not just someone you don't like. Whether at war or at work, we identify enemies and try to protect ourselves from them. Shantideva raises a very deep issue in his definition of the true enemy. Is there an enemy that harms us again and again, in a thousand ways, from every angle, at every opportunity, robbing us of happiness and giving us misery? Shantideva says yes, and this true enemy is self-centeredness. Self-centeredness is the attitude thinking, my well-being is most important. With self-centeredness, we demand everything good for ourselves, the good house, the good income and job, the good friends, the good family. Everyone else can have what is left over. From the Buddhist perspective, self-centeredness has dominated our minds since time immemorial, throughout all previous lifetimes. Self-centeredness promises to look after us as our servant, just as we take care of it. Self-centeredness presents itself as our indispensable number one ally and advises us that if we don't cooperate, we will lose all the good stuff, everything. We will never get anywhere because if we don't take care of ourselves first, other people will get everything we want. Self-centeredness presents itself as being our loyal ally in the search for happiness. The Buddhist tradition tells us just the opposite. Seeking happiness with an attitude of self-centeredness is in reality the greatest source of suffering. Self-centeredness is like a spy who has infiltrated the society of our minds, our worst enemy posing as a trusted personal counselor. Shantideva says, other enemies come and go, but our greatest enemy, the true enemy, destroys our very well-being every day. Its name is self-centeredness. There is a simple reason why self-centeredness damages us again and again. Self-centeredness puts us at odds with virtually everyone else on the planet, who are also, just as we are, acting out of self-centeredness. Shantideva makes the radical suggestion that we suspect this apparent ally, who is in reality our worst enemy, and examine it closely. Does self-centeredness bring happiness or suffering? If adversity is examined carefully, it is found to have no inherent existence. Adversity appears as adversity because of our self-centeredness. Self-centeredness is what makes our problems large and other people's problems seem insignificant. Okay. So then let's have a look at this commentary here on how to banish all blame to a single source, meaning to how to see that it's our self-grasping, self-cherishing mind that is the true enemy, the real enemy that constantly harms us. So it says here, how to reflect on this. In the commentary in the middle of page 99, it says, reflect. All shortcomings and defects I may possess originate from my grasping at selfhood. From beginningless time, I have held onto a self when there was none. So again, grasping onto the idea that there is an independent me when there is no independent me here. Wherever I was born, although there was no self, I have grasped at my body as the basis of my selfhood. So again, we're constantly grasping onto this me here, believing that there's an independent me here. So this is grasping itself. Taking its side, I have resorted to rejection and affirmation, depending on whether I deem something desirable or undesirable. So again, we can see here the same idea as we had in this six steps of suffering and its causes. By grasping onto self, therefore, when we experience things and we have pleasant and unpleasant experiences or desirable and undesirable experiences, then we reject or affirm them depending on whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, meaning we have attachment to the pleasant ones and we have aversion to the unpleasant ones. In this manner, and so these are driving, of course, all of our other mental afflictions and our behavior. In this manner, I have committed all three, deception, duplicity, and deviousness, nice words, toward others, and as a consequence, I have accumulated afflictions and negative karma over and over again. This has compelled me since beginning this time to endure the incalculable sufferings of cyclic existence in general and the immeasurable sufferings of the three lower realms in particular. So again here, it's just this whole paragraph is again more or less stating the same as we saw before, that if we have this grasping at me, there's independent me, independent world, then when we have these pleasant and unpleasant experiences, that will lead to attachment to the pleasant ones, aversion to the unpleasant ones. that will lead to all the other mental afflictions, such as jealousy and craving, resentment, fear, anxiety, depression. All of these come out of either attachment, aversion, or a combination of them. That is driving our behavior. And then particularly if we're engaging in negative behavior, that ends up leading to a lot of suffering in this and future lives. And then again, he's quoting Shantideva, so this three-line quote, again, is coming from chapter 8 of Shantideva's text. Although countless eons have passed with such great hardships, you have sought only suffering. Meaning that we are looking for happiness, but because of our ignorance and mental afflictions, we're just continually inflicting suffering upon ourselves and others. So long as I fail to view this, the self, as the enemy, so long I will continue to seek the well-being of this self. Meaning as long as we don't understand that this self-grasping, self-cherishing mind is the enemy, we're going to continue in our pursuit of our happiness simply to inflict more and more suffering on ourselves through our, particularly our non-virtuous behavior. Consequently, I will accumulate negative karma. This will compel me in the future to wander in this infinite cycle of existence where I'll suffer even more and for longer than before. So this cherishing of self brings about all the suffering of the three times. So three times, of course, is past, present, future. Since this self has been my own executioner and my enemy from beginningless time, then in all the deaths I have experienced in the beginningless cycle of existence, no one else has done the killing. Rather, I have been killed by my own self. Again, self-grasping, self-cherishing. As if biting your lower lip, firmly hold your own self as the enemy. So again, we have to understand that it's a self-grasping, self-cherishing mind is the enemy. Where is this enemy? It is in your own heart. And again, quoting Shantideva, if this ancient enemy long settled, the sole cause of steadily increasing hosts of harms, has found its home within my heart, my very heart, how can there be joy for me within this cyclic existence? This is coming from chapter 4 of his text, Bodhisattva Charyavatara. And then the commentary goes on. Think that this kind of behavior, and here is a strange Tibetan saying, living on the head yet not giving victory to the eyes is most inappropriate. I think, and there's a footnote there, and from memory, the footnote was saying that there is a sort of a little bit different modern day Tibetan quote, which is something like, something about living in the head but throwing mud in the eyes, and it basically means to, even though someone has benefited you, in return you harm them. I think that's sort of what this quote maybe means. Or the opposite. So, you know that, and so I think this is talking here about this self-cherishing mind is not having the right understanding that self-cherishing is really the enemy. Thus, the focus, or the site of this self-grasping, which is the source of all defects, is the very body you are born into. Since beginningless time, you have held on to an I when there was none. So again, this is grasping on to me, this self-grasping. So when there was none. So it's not saying there's no person. What it's saying is there is no independent me. And have held on to a self when there was none. Self-grasping is fraught with defects and is a source of all suffering. So to cherish, look at, and protect this discolored human corpse, they're very descriptive language here in the ancient Tibetan Buddhism, a lump of pus and blood and a sack of mucus, is like carrying a bag of thorns on your back while naked. Happiness could result if you let go. So here, what we mean by let go, of course, is to let go of grasping onto self. But instead, you believe that pursuing self-interest will bring you happiness and thus sink even deeper into suffering as though you craved it. So again, to a quote related to that again is in Shanti Deva's chapter 8 of his text. Whatever suffering is in the world arises from wishing for one's own happiness. So this is talking about the self-cherishing mind. Whatever happiness is in the world arises for the wish for others' happiness. So this is the mind of cherishing others. What need is there to say more? The childish pursue their own interests while the Buddhas act for the welfare of others. Observe the difference between these two. And then if we go on a little bit more, it says, among all the afflictions that have harmed you since beginning this time, this self-grasping is the worst. Because remember again, self-grasping is the root of all of the other mental afflictions. Without grasping onto self, then there would be no other mental afflictions. This jealous, evil-ridden force that makes beings commit negative acts against all other beings, from high spiritual teachers to lice, resides here in you. It obstructs the attainment of freedom from cyclic existence and ties beings further into bondage. This force welcomes all human, non-human agents of harm. Here's another little Tibetan saying. This owl-headed betrayer is the very mind that grasps onto an I or self and seeks only its own selfish ends. Owl-headed betrayer, in Tibetan culture or folklore, is an owl that is hooting at night time is an omen that something bad is about to happen. So that's why this term owl-headed betrayer, that our self-grasping is an omen that something bad is about to happen because of that's driving our bad behavior. Thinking in this manner, you should recognize the enemy as the enemy. So again, another quote from Shanti Deva, chapter 8. Within all the hundreds of world systems of cyclic existence, this has harmed me. Rouse your vengeance thus and destroy thoughts of self-interest. If you feel unable to eradicate this self-grasping, then cultivate the following thought. This time it is different. Today I have sought a spiritual teacher, I have read the sutras, and as a result I have now recognized the enemy. It has been stated. The old days when you could ruin me at will are now gone. I can see you now, so where are you off to? I shall tear down your arrogance. So again, he's talking about looking at self-grasping, self-cherishing mind. Contemplate along these lines, and whenever any self-centered thought arises, the master said, so again, from Geshe Chikawa, you should be cognizant and strike at the snout of the boar with a cane. So again, another Tibetan saying, and I have a little answer to this one. It makes a lot of sense actually. So this is mentioned in this book from Alan Wallace on page 220. To strike the snout of a boar with the cane. There are actually two related sayings here. And he says the following. There is an old Tibetan aphorism Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche used. So Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, he was a great modern-day master in the Nyingma tradition. And he said, the same as here, he said, hit the pig on the nose. And the second saying is, clean the lamp while still warm. So what do those two sayings mean? It says here, this wisdom stems from rural Tibet, where the animals make themselves at home on the bottom floor of the house. Sometimes the animals climb upstairs into the bedrooms and kitchen. What do you do when a pig pokes its snout through the kitchen door looking for stuff to munch? Hit him on the nose before he gets the other 200 pounds through the door. Hit the pig on the nose quick enough and he turns tail. But a pig that is already feeding at the trough is hard to get rid of. Meaning that to not wait until our self-grasping, self-cherishing mind has got too strong, or our mental afflictions are too strong, then it's hard to get them out of there. We're out of control. So the trick is to notice when self-grasping, self-cherishing, or any mental afflictions are about to arise, and then hit them on the snout with the cane, meaning don't allow them to take control of our mind. The same goes, here's the second saying. The second saying was, clean the lamp while still warm. It says here, the same goes for kerosene lamps. Cleaning a lamp when it is warm is easy. Wait until it is cold and you have a gritty problem. Meaning, as soon as you identify afflictive tendencies of the mind, as soon as their snouts poke through the door of your mind, hit them on the nose and clean the lamp of your mind while it is still warm with afflictions. These are not abstract philosophical concepts. Okay, so if we continue on, it says, therefore it was taught that as far as the subject matter of all the teachings of the Great Vehicle is concerned, so Great Vehicle again is the Mahayana, where the wisdom and compassion is the bodhicitta and emptiness, there are only two themes, totally let going of self-grasping and upholding sentient beings with deep concern. So again here, we talk about the two bodhicittas. So the two themes here is to, it says here, to let go of self-grasping. So the antidote to self-grasping of course is ultimate bodhicitta or the emptiness practice. And here the other theme it says is upholding sentient beings with deep concern, which is the cherishing others, which is the basis here of the conventional bodhicitta. So the antidote to that, of course, is an antidote to the self-cherishing mind. So then here we're looking now at this level of the text, how to take adverse conditions into the path using conventional bodhicitta. So here then, we are to understand that the real enemy is the self-cherishing mind, and the real friend is the mind of cherishing others. It's others who are our friend, and it's the self-cherishing who's the enemy. On this basis, crippling self-grasping as much as you can and nurturing sentient beings as much as you can. So I think so far everything is fairly straightforward. Any questions of anything we've covered so far? Yes.
Don't you think that, you know, blaming everything on the self-cherishing mind is good for a monk, but not for every strata of society? See, just hear me out now. You know, for example, the Tibetans have been invaded by the Chinese. Should the Tibetans blame everything on their self-cherishing mind and not blame the Chinese for the invasion? Because they have had a lot of hardship because of the invasion.
Why did the Chinese invade Tibet? Maybe because of their self-cherishing mind. So it's the self-cherishing mind we're blaming.
Of the Chinese.
Sure.
But
what we do, of course, is we blame people, we punish people, don't we? We get angry at people. And we punish people.
See, it has to be different for different members of the society. If there is a monk who feels this way, I'm fine with it. But an ordinary Tibetan who has been invaded by the Chinese, and he can't be blaming his self-cherishing mind for the invasion and the hardship. There has to be somebody, and at that point of time when the aggression took place, Tibet had no army because they thought that it was the least form of life, human life, so soldiers is not a good idea. The country collapsed to the Chinese invasion, and even in my view, the response is fairly meek right now. I mean, what is this about self-evolution? Where a suicide vest and get the country to Chinese to negotiate with you? It looks very meek to me. And it's good for a monk, but do you think it is good for other members of the
society? You feel that blaming others and getting angry and fighting with others is a good way forward?
But what happened, for example, in Tibet, they should not be blaming at that point of time their self-cherishing mind for the destruction that happened in Tibet post the invasion.
I don't think this is what he's saying that. They're not saying that here.
Everything to be blamed, every hardship...
To self-cherishing, yes.
The self-cherishing mind, right. Not the self-cherishing
mind. And right, so if Chinese or other created destruction on others, then it's the self-cherishing mind of the Chinese that are to blame.
We lost the country.
Yeah, but I mean, isn't it the self-cherishing of the Chinese or the people who created the... Isn't that what it's saying here?
They should have been taught a lesson. The Tibetans should not have viewed it that way at any point.
That will increase the anger. And how should we teach people a lesson?
I see. This attitude led to Tibet's weak army, is my view. It's so much of religiosity that you have an assembly line of enlightened people. But a country or a society doesn't need only enlightened people. It needs enlightened people, it needs soldiers, it needs businessmen and everybody. This looks like a very monk teaching to me.
Personally, I don't think so. I think what we need to do is we need to interpret this in the good, correct way. Otherwise, of course, we can come up with all sorts of strange ideas. I think some of the answers to your questions are still going to come in the text, hopefully. But again, what we're saying, the suffering there is coming from the self-cherishing mind of the people who want to dominate others, isn't it? So therefore it is self-cherishing that is to blame for that suffering.
Chinese.
In that case, yeah. And in the case, we often also provoke a lot of suffering on ourselves because of our own self-cherishing mind, don't we? Isn't it? I mean, that's all that's being said here. Yeah. Yeah. That we're saying is the self-cherishing mind that leads to suffering. Both in our own case and for others. Anyone who acts out of self-cherishing, that's where all suffering can be traced back to. I mean, that's what Shanti Dev is saying, is whatever suffering is in the world all comes from wishing one's own happiness. Whatever happiness is in the world arises from wishing others' happiness. So if we have a self-cherishing mind, if anyone else has a self-cherishing mind, that will often lead to harmful, non-virtuous behavior and suffering. That's all that's being said. Yeah, in that sense. But I think there's a lot more to come here anyway, because there is also more to answering this question than what I've just said, but I think that's going to come as well.
We're talking about smashing and doing stuff with
ourselves. To see it as our enemy, yeah.
I think one of the thoughts said first you made it a friend.
Friend.
Their analogy was that if you speak harshly to your best friend, probably he will not remain your best friend.
But as we're going to see here, when we're talking about getting rid of self-cherishing, of course, if we have aversion to that, then that's not what we're talking about here. Yeah. So I think what maybe she was talking about there is to make it our friend means to see it for what it is and then deal with it properly instead of, you know, as we do now, if some mental affliction comes up, we sort of try and push it away. We have aversion to it. So in that sense, to make it a friend would mean to acknowledge it and not to try and suppress it. But to make it a friend doesn't mean allow it to overwhelm our mind. So I'm sure she wasn't saying, making self-cherishing a friend, oh, just let it do what its thing. Don't allow self-cherishing to run its course. I'm sure she didn't mean that. I think what she meant was perhaps when self-cherishing comes up, don't sort of suppress it or try and have aversion to it. To be a friend means to see it in front clearly and then deal with it in that sense.
Deal with it would be not to feed it.
To feel it. To feed it. Yeah, of course, feeding it is not dealing with it. And then, of course, there are many advice here about how to do that. It's coming.
Now, as a beginner, I'm asking, but you say, obviously, I have a lot of personal stuff I need to deal with before, yeah? And we shouldn't go and judge other people. But let's say you meet someone else and you encounter that self-cherish in mind. How?
In that person?
Yeah. Well,
yeah, as with all of this whole thing, wisdom and compassion. You use wisdom and compassion, meaning that if someone has a self-cherishing mind and that's leading them to speak or behave in a very, not a very good way, not to attack them with anger or hatred, that's not going to help anything. Use the compassionate state of mind as a motivation of wishing to help that person, and then the wisdom has to come in and go, well, how can I, you know, what can I do to sort of help this person? So if, of course, they're in full rage or something, then maybe the wisdom says, okay, I think I need to just step back here and not do anything, because anything I say will just, it's like throwing petrol on the fire when they're in that state. So wisdom then may say, okay, let me just step back for a moment until they sort of blow off some steam and they become a bit more calm. Then wisdom says, okay, now let's see what I can do to try to help that person. Maybe to try to get that person to see how that sort of behavior is not helping anything. It's just making the situation worse. Or maybe if they're very open, then discuss how better to see the situation in a better way. I mean, of course, each situation is different. We have to evaluate every situation on its own merit. And we have to evaluate the person's state of mind, all of these factors to try and see how best to be productive in our response.
That would be best in the case we have a very calm mind.
Well, hopefully we have a calm mind. If we don't, then that's difficult.
That relates, I think, to the first about if that person is coming from self-grafting and he acts as a condition for our self-grafting to arrive.
Yeah. You mean like our mind is already out of control?
Our mind begins to have this self-grafting as well, and then there is like this clash. The question is...
But we can have self-grasping and be compassionate. You mean self-cherishing, I think.
Maybe.
Yeah. I mean, self-grasping, I mean, pretty well in all of our activities, we have self-grasping, even when we're compassionate. There is this sort of me here who's helping that person over there. It's really the self-cherishing that comes from self-grasping that really starts to head in towards the direction of maybe some non-virtuous behavior.
So would you say that we need to have the self-grasping but maintain the motivation of benefit the other?
Of course, of course. Yeah, of course. Because now we do. We grasp on. There's me here. There's a poor beggar there. And I want to try and help them. And that's where we are now. But that's okay. What we need to try and do, of course, is not allow the self-grasping to turn into self-cherishing.
When that happens, usually the motivation is out the window. And
of course. Well, it depends. If it's strong, yes. I mean, if you've got strong self-cherishing, then it's difficult. I mean, any strong mental affliction, we're already starting to get out of control. So then, if we notice a strong mental affliction in our mind, maybe better not open our mouth. Otherwise, we're just going to make things worse. Maybe better try and calm down, you know, take a couple of deep breaths and relax a bit, then check the motivation, and then maybe try and say something in this difficult situation.
Not believing what
self-cherishing
tells us to do, a valid
response. Not believing. Right. You're asking, is that a good thing to do? Yeah, of course, because we are starting to see self-cherishing as the enemy, that it's not really our friend. And so therefore, you know, we can let it go. We don't have to get caught up in it. Yeah, sure. Sure.
Going to the top of page 100.
100.
My ignorance a little bit here. My materialistic mind is stuck on a concept.
Yeah.
In relation to the continual reference to the heart, our heart, within my very heart.
Yeah.
What heart are we talking about?
Generally here, this is sort of, I think, I'd have to see what the Tibetan would, how they translated from Tibetan into that. So I don't know for sure, what that is, but I think that is talking about in the very core of our mind.
Yeah, I've been thinking through this for a long, long time. I've had a lot of difficulty because I keep identifying with my heart. That doesn't make sense. We're talking about a mind and a spiritual level, and then we start talking about a part of our anatomy then.
Yeah. I'd have to check the Tibetan here, but sometimes the word which is translated into heart, the Tibetan word means essence. So at the very essence of our mind, within the core of our mind. So I think this is what it's meaning. And sometimes in English we have that, you know, the heart of the matter. The very heart of the matter means the core of the matter. So I think it's here saying that at the very core of our mind is this self-cherishing mind. Yeah. In that sense, I don't think it's talking about the physical heart.
No.
Yes. We have to do open heart surgery, get rid of that self-cherishing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, in our English language, sometimes we sort of talk about thinking and feeling, and usually we associate thinking with the head and the feeling, the emotion, with the heart, because that's where we sort of experience them. So yes, in that sense. Sure. Okay. Let's then keep going in the text here. It says, furthermore, since all the sacred scriptures and treatises were taught for the purpose of subduing the afflictions, it is the afflictions that must be subdued by means of them. In general, there are 84,000 afflictions. So sometimes we hear that the Buddha gave 84,000 teachings, one for each of the 84,000 afflictions, all of which, when subsumed, fall into 212 classes. I think that footnote there from memory is saying that in his research he never found where these 212 classes, what they were. I think from memory. When subsumed, they in turn fall into the class of the 6 root afflictions and the 20 derivative afflictions. So this is what we looked at before, is that generally when we get an extensive presentation of the mental afflictions in Buddhist psychology, you'll have the 6 root mental afflictions and the 20 secondary mental afflictions. So I'll just briefly mention the 6 root ones because they come up very often. So the first 3, of course, are the 3 poisons, the 3 core ones that we looked at. And then the other 3 are pride, doubt, deluded view. This word pride, we have to be a little bit careful, because sometimes the word pride in English language is used in reference to feeling good about something. That's not what this word here means. So sometimes it's called afflicted pride. And pride is a sort of a puffed up state of mind, thinking we're more special. So it's the pride is this sort of puffed up state of mind. So it's not about feeling good about ourselves or being self-confident or so forth. It's this sort of puffed up attitude. Doubt here is, as you might realize, assume, doubt is a sort of a mind that wavers between two things, not sure about A or B. And deluded view is a view where we don't see things clearly, we don't see things in the way they are. And this deluded view can be further divided into five deluded views, which I won't go into because that's too much detail. So sometimes then, instead of the six root mental afflictions, they'll have a list of the ten mental afflictions, which are these five plus this deluded view that's divided into five variations of deluded view. So then we get a list of the ten mental afflictions. But more commonly, you will just see the list of six, and then that can be reduced to the three poisons. And then, of course, the basis of the three poisons is this ignorance, is this self-grasping. So we can go down to the sort of the main one of self-grasping, which I think is what's now comes in the text here. It says, these two can be further subsumed into the five or three poisons. When subsumed further, they are reduced into the single affliction, namely the self-grasping alone. He who has subdued it to the highest degree enjoys the highest degree of happiness, to a medium degree of happiness, minimal degree of happiness. He who has not subdued it to any degree will enjoy no happiness at all. So the root of suffering is self-grasping. So again, we've really seen that a number of times through that suffering and its causes chart. And since all faults and defects are contingent upon this, you must from now on abandon any clinging to the body and mind and instead regard them as your enemies. So what is the enemy again is self-grasping. And also, of course, we can relate to that to grasping to the body, grasping to the mind, or any sort of grasping. Most importantly, you must abandon your clinging to the body. On this, and so again, he's quoting Shantideva over the page. If I am attached to my body, fear arises from even slight degree dangers. This body that brings so much fear, who would not detest it like an enemy? So again, here, I think this goes back a little bit to maybe a quote earlier in this book, where he said that we have pain and suffering, and that suffering comes from grasping. So just to sort of clarify that is, and I can use my own experience as a sort of a basis to explain. Many years ago, I did a Goenka Vipassana retreat next door here, and just before I started that retreat, I damaged my knee in a sporting accident. So I couldn't really sit cross-legged more than about 15 minutes, otherwise it got very painful. So I had to sort of move quite regularly in the one-hour sessions that we were doing. But then at some point in the retreat, the instruction was to develop strong determination, to sit still for 1 hour without moving, to develop, you know, this perseverance and not just keep moving unnecessarily. So I had some determination, so I sat and was determined. But after about 15, 20 minutes, my knee really started to hurt a lot, to the point where I had some sort of overwhelming sort of suffering. But at that time, the instruction was to scan the body for sensations, to just observe pleasant, unpleasant sensations without reacting. And part of the instruction was, if you got to a point in the body where there were some intense sensations, just sit there for a moment and observe. So, of course, when I got to my knee, there was very intense sensation. In fact, overwhelming pain, overwhelming suffering. And if I managed to sit there and my mindfulness was good enough and I was focused enough, then what happened was this intense singular suffering or pain broke up into smaller bits of pain, and it kept breaking up and up, and eventually it was just a mass of intense sensations, which are obviously telling me that I need to attend to something there. But as long as I saw clearly what was there, as long as I directly, because all that was there was lots of intense sensations, that's all that was there, as long as I could clearly see that, then actually it didn't overwhelm me. I could sit with that okay. And in some way it felt a bit pleasant, actually, because it was very intense. But as soon as my mindfulness lost my mindfulness, as soon as I interpreted that sensation as pain, then immediately my aversion kicked in and I don't want that. And I experienced overwhelming suffering. Overwhelming. So what I understood from that was that most, if not all, the suffering I was experiencing was not because of the sensations in my knee, but because of my aversion. And that aversion, of course, came from grasping. Me, I don't want that. Go away. And it was my aversion that, in my experience there, created all, if not all, most of my suffering. If I didn't have that aversion because I had good mindfulness, the self-grasping was very much dormant, I could quite easily sit with that. Of course, it was intense and it was signaling to me to do, you know, to pay attention to it, so I wasn't ignoring it. But that's, I think, what's being mentioned here a little bit, is that even if we have some discomfort in the body, most of the suffering that we often experience is self-induced through this aversion. The stronger the aversion, coming from strong self-grasping, the more suffering. And we know that a little bit from our own experience. For example, maybe, let's say, where we've come into an accident or something, but not just us are hurt, maybe our partner or friend is hurt, then often we're very concerned about our partner or the friend, meaning that the self-grasping, self-cherishing mind is not strong. The mind of cherishing others is really kicked in. So much so that we may have a serious injury, but it doesn't really bother us much. And we're attending to the others. It's only when we stop doing that and we look at our arm and see that it's quite broken, then we go, oh, and we have overwhelming suffering. Isn't that true? So, therefore, we can understand here what this is saying at a deeper level is that a lot of our suffering is coming from the self-grasping and then the aversion. Because I don't want this. Go away. So, I think that's something we can try to understand here as well. So if we just finish this paragraph and then we'll stop for today. I'll reflect. Although I have striven hard since beginning this time to benefit this body, it is in the nature of a material object that feels no joy or pain in relation to any benefit or injury. As for the mind, it is devoid of substantial reality and empty. Since what appears conventionally right now comes into being from causes and conditions, it is devoid of self-defining identity. Furthermore, since the causes and effects cease every moment, there is nothing that is established following its origination. So this can be very helpful in letting go of that self-grasping, which is causing the self-cherishing, which is leading to a lot of our suffering through the aversion to some difficult situation. Therefore, you should think, in the past I have been preoccupied with worthless, ruinous pursuits. Now I should regard my own self as the enemy, self-grasping, self-cherishing, and should call upon all eight classes of worldly gods, demigods and demons, and all 80,000 families of obstructive forces to withdraw their support of this self. So again, in ancient Tibet, before Buddhism came to Tibet, there was the Burn tradition. And in the Burn tradition, they had a lot of practices involving interacting with spirits and demons and so forth. So you see a lot of this in some of these instructions that are coming in terms of how to work with these different beings in a good way. Of course, I think most of us maybe don't even have a belief in a lot of these things, and probably many of us have never experienced these beings. So, but in certainly in the ancient Tibetan system, particularly before Buddhism became, there was a lot of practice involved with pacifying demons and working and dealing with other spirit beings. And so that's why you see some of these instructions related to that coming in the text. But in some of those instructions, I think we can use those very same instructions and interpret them in a slightly different way and use them in a different way as well. Then it goes on to say here, train with the thought, be my ally and help me vanquish this self-grasping. Help. Here I think there's something a little bit strange in the, not quite correct in the translation. It says, help make my five aggregates devoid of any substantial reality and empty. I mean, of course we can't make them empty because they are already. So maybe they've left out a word here like, help make me realize that my five aggregates are devoid of substantial reality and empty. That would make more sense. But the way it's worded there, I think there's a problem in the translation. There's something not quite right. By engaging in these practices, the master entreated, strive to the best of your ability to subdue this self-grasping demon during your brief life. So maybe we'll sort of stop there for today because we've more or less run out of time. But any last question then on anything we've just covered before we finish? Yes.
How to handle knee pain? I think I'm not the only one here. Both my knees are not so well.
Yeah. So again, with any difficult situation, and there's going to be some more advice about this and other things coming in the text in the next section, but the one thing we don't want to do is to have aversion. Because by having aversion, by going, oh, not that knee pain again, go away, all that will guarantee is you will suffer more. Guaranteed. Because it's our aversion to difficult situations that creates a lot of our suffering. Of course, there's some discomfort there to begin with. So then what we can do is follow Shantideva's advice. If a situation can be remedied, why get upset? Just fix it. Meaning, if the knee's hurting, and if you move it a bit, and it fixes it, do that. You don't need to get upset. And then the second part of the advice is, if a situation cannot be remedied, what's the point in getting upset? Meaning, for example, we've got a migraine headache, and even taking medication doesn't really help. We just have to wait it out. No point in getting upset. It doesn't help. So in that situation, if it can be remedied, just fix it. If it can't, at least don't get upset. So meaning, whatever the situation, do not develop aversion to the knee discomfort. If you can move and it releases that discomfort, then do it. If it doesn't, then at least don't have aversion to it, because that's not going to help. It's just going to mean that you will suffer more. And one of the pieces of advice coming is that not only for this, but for sickness and all sorts of things, we can use those situations to develop loving kindness and compassion. Because if you have some discomfort, you can think, okay, I'm sure I'm not the only one with knee pain. In fact, there are probably thousands of other people on the planet who have much worse things than knee pain. So by me willingly accepting this discomfort, may all others be free of theirs, and take all that on, and then give them healthy body or whatever. So if we do that, then we won't have the aversion, and we can use that to develop loving kindness and compassion. But of course, we're not suggesting to sit there and damage your knees. No, that's not ever the recommendation. But if we have a little bit of discomfort in the knee and we know that that's not really damaging the knee, then we can happily sit with that and use it in that way. Of course, if there is strong discomfort in the knee and we might be damaging our knee to continue to sit like that, then we should not continue to sit like that. We should move or sit in a chair or use a stool or so forth in that sense. But I think in this case and related cases, some practical advice is coming in the next section of the text. Okay. So let's leave it there and finish today and have a break, and then again 5:15 with Richard, and I'll see you tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.